Today is January 31st. We are learning Chamesh Megillos, and we spent much of the first class doing some historical background about the time between the destruction of Bayis Rishon and the building of Bayis Sheni, and where the Purim story fits in that. I just wanted this is probably the best thing that's out there. It's called Purim in the Persian Empire by Yuval Landy. Have you seen it? It is the best thing out there, I'll tell you, from the standpoint of our Masorah, of accepting what's written in Tanakh, with a full discussion of the Persian history. Okay? We do have a full list of the Persian kings. Right? You have that before you. Ahasuerus is not one of them. But there are some kings on that list that what we know about them fit very nicely in what may be Ahasuerus. Nothing definitive, because there are numerous opinions amongst the Jewish scholars which one of these kings is indeed Ahasuerus. And you will see that even amongst Chazal, that there does not seem to be a full consensus. Okay. Last class we talked about some 164 or so missing years in this Cheshbon of Kings. I'm not going to review that. Please, I ain't shown the review. Okay. But at the bottom of the page you're looking at with the list, right, might explain why the Megillah starts off Vayhi bimei Achashverosh. It was in the days of Achashverosh. And by the way, who Achashverosh Hamalech Neirdu Bet Kusheva Vesuvimei Amedina? Why do I have to repeat his name? It was in the days of Achashverosh. You know which Achashverosh? The one who ruled over 127. So look at the list and tell me why you might want.
There's four different.
Right, because there are a bunch of different Artaxerxes, if he's one of them, right? He may be even the Xerxes, some scholars say. At the very end of Megillas Esther, remember his name is spelled like this. Right? It could be a Hebraized form of Xerxes. But assuming that Ahasuerus ought to be one of these guys, right? So that's the first thing is, since there is more than one of them, the Megillah wants to start off and is aware of this and tells us, you know which Ahasuerus we're talking about? This is the kingdom of Persia at its height. The other side. That is not larger than anything until that was ever conquered. The dark space is the conquered space. Right? You'll recognize Europe and Asia in there. Right? No one until Alexander the Great conquered that much land. Okay? Persians conquered the Babylonians exactly as Yirmiyahu had said, 70 years from the year that Nebuchadnezzar ascended the throne. That is a prophecy in chapter 25 of Sefer Yirmiyahu. He also prophesied that 70 years after the destruction of the temple, the Jews would return. Right? There was a little confusion between those two 70-year periods. It's okay, there's supposed to be confusion about our Geula. You ever hear of a medrash that a tribe thought that the 400 years were over 30 years before it was really over?
Yeah.
Which tribe?
Was it Ephraim?
Ephraim, correct.
That's why you had to go around
the Rashi mentions that in his Beresh to Parshas by Bishalach. Okay? Alright, so the time is you're not supposed to have an appointed day. Right? On this day, you're all coming back. It's supposed to be somewhat nebulous, if you will, so that people are more, going, oh, no, I'm going to be 70 years from now, I'll be ready then. No, tomorrow, the Cholyom Shiyahu. Again, that's the Musa behind it, okay? So Yirmiyahu mentions two separate 70-year cheshbonot of the Geula, okay? And I assure you that there was broad confusion amongst the masses because And here, at the bottom of the page that shows the map of the kingdom, there is a list of prophets' names. You see that? It's crucial to really appreciate the main message of Megillat Esther to understand how everything that connects to Megillat Esther is represented in these prophets. That is the topic of today's lecture. To have a cursory understanding of what these prophets are about with respect to their relationship to this book. Okay? In so doing, we will explain the Maamar Chazal that I mentioned the first class. It's online, yutorah.org, if you want to listen to it again, but I'm just reviewing that now for a moment. We will explain the Maamar Chazal, Esther min HaTorah Minayin. Where is Esther hinted at the Torah? A question that is asked only about this book. You don't see a Gemara with David min HaTorah Minayin, Shmuel min HaTorah Minayin, Eliyahu min HaTorah Minayin. The reason for such a question is because this book, do you remember?
It doesn't include God's name.
This book was kemat not canonized. The Gilad Daf Zayin speaks about Esther having a heck of a time trying to convince the rabbis that this book should be canonized, should be included as a holy book of the Bible. Their main taina was, where is a moral message in the book? Okay, you've fasted for 3 days, but what? And God's name isn't even in it, right? So, because it was not canonized, not immediately canonized, so Esther had to show, no, I'll show you, the Torah predicted what would happen here. Where is that? Tell me. It says at the end of Devarim,
Asater,
Anochi, Aster, Astir Panai Mikem Bayomahu. I will hide my face from you when you're in the Gaulis, if you worship idols and you deserve to be exiled. When you're in the exile, I will hide. Have you heard of Hester Panim? Right? You familiar with that concept? God's face is hidden. He sees us, we don't see him. Right? It's enough times. You saw, you understood, you saw manifestations of God. You have a prophet named Eliyahu. He performed miracles or he predicted things. Right? Okay. So I will hide my face from you, Esther said, see, that's our story. What's what is Rashi's explanation of this connection? This is actually not a Gemara in Megillah. This is a Gemara in Chulin, the end of Chulin. Strange reason why you expect to find that this statement in Maseches Megillah, right? It's in Maseches Chulin. Okay. The common way to understand what this means, I will hide my face from you, manifest in the story of Esther is that God's name doesn't appear. It's hidden. Why does God's name not appear? Because the ones who publicized this story were the Persian runners, the Partimim, the Nehramachim, right? Achashtar Pnim, the runners of the Persians. You couldn't put God, our God, as the main force behind everything that's happening. You have to put Achashverosh as the main man. So the runners will be very happy and proud to publicize this story. We didn't have the wherewithal to send people into every town. Hear ye, listen to this, what happened to the Jews. The Persians who did it. Says so in the story. Okay, you got it? So that's why we took God's name out of it. My thesis now is that what this Gemara really means is to tell us that the true nature of this story is hidden. This is not a story about an anti-Semite who tried to kill the Jews, and whoa, we had tucked in the right place at the right time was someone who just knew how to save the day, and lo and behold, her uncle had some insider information about a plot on the king's life, which helped bring him up to fame and to take down the guy, the anti-Semite. Do you think that's the whole point of the story? Let me tell you something. It's take out an Encyclopedia Judaica, letter P for Purim, open up to Purim, and you'll see 100 such stories like that in Jewish history. Why would they do such a thing? Because the Gemara says, if you have a community that faced destruction, faced a pogrom, and at the last minute, some force, some person, some bribe, something managed to save the community, right? That community on that day shall have, between this year and next year, have someone write up the story, read it publicly, obviously not from a cloth with, you know, written like the Torah, but they shall read the story and say Hallel on that day every single year from then on. We don't know such things today, but because we're living in relative, security, but there you'll find 100 or more such historical events. That is not the point of this book in the Ksuvim part of Tanakh. The main point of the book is hidden from us. And I'm going to help you find it. You will only find it, though, if you look at this list of prophets, which I'm about to go through all of them, and I'm going to tell you what every one of these books is about, but just enough that you need to know in order to understand what this hidden message is. You ready? Put your seatbelts on, we're going fast. The first prophet is going to be Yirmiyahu. First one is Yirmiyahu Chavdal. Yirmiyahu walked the streets carrying two baskets. One with beautiful figs, and one with disgusting, despicable figs that when you look at, you want to throw up. It's a short little chapter. He walks through the city with them, and the people say, Yirmiyahu, what are those two baskets about? And he tells him, this good basket of figs, this one that's wonderful that you want to eat right now, those are the Jews who surrendered to the Babylonians. The bad figs, those are the Jews who put up a fight. Because I submit to you, there is a 70-year galus. There is no avoiding it. You're stuck with it. Okay? You got it? With me? I will tell you that, just parenthetically, in chapter 28 and 29, there was a false prophet named Hananiah ben Azur who predicted there would only be a 2-year galus. We're all coming back in 2 years. All the Caleb of the Beis HaMikdash, they'll all be brought back in 2 years. Yirmiyahu said, and he establishes a rule of prophecy with this. Yirmiyahu said, I hope that he'll come back in 2 years. And I'm not, there's an English word called Jeremiad, which is a prediction of doom, usually politically. That's not fair. He gets a bad shape, right? He's just telling what God tells him. And God tells him that it's a bad time and it helped them. But he says that, if we do return after 2 years, that's not a sign that I'm a liar. That's a sign that you finally listened to me and did an amazing tshuva. Because God is always standing there waiting for you to come home. He wants you to come home. All right? But you know when you'll see that he's a liar? If you're following me, when will that be?
After 2 years.
When after 2 years we don't come back, then you know he's a liar. Because when God makes a prophecy for good, a public prophecy for good from a prophet, it must always come true. He never goes back on a good prophecy, but he's always going back on bad prophecies. There are a good few examples in Yirmiyahu itself. Yirmiyahu predicted that no one from his hometown, from Anatot, will ever return from the Golos because they're so wicked. 123 people from Anatot returned after the Golos to save Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay, got it? He predicted that King Yehoiachin would die childless. He had a child. His grandson was Zerubbabel. Okay, famous person who saved the battle of Concord. Okay, it's Babel Zerubbabel. Right? So we see that a good prophecy has to come true. The bad prophecy may always change. Right? But I'm telling you now, Yirmiyahu says, there's a very harsh, strong decree of a 70-year galus. And your best way to resolve that galus is to surrender when the Babylonians come. You know what will happen then? They'll let you stay. They'll let you stay in your homes. They will not destroy the temple. They will not kill the king. Get this? Right? They're just going to put you to confiscatory taxation. They're going to administer this country, and they will act as if though they're in charge. What did the Turk have to say the Iranians would do if they took over the Knesset? Right? Better to do that, right? Okay. The reason why I mentioned that example is because it was about as popular as that. People didn't want to listen to this. They said the God who humbled the Egyptians when we didn't have an army can conquer these Babylonians. And Yirmiyahu said, absolutely he can. He can send a nice earthquake and just wipe out the Babylonians tomorrow. Right? Or a big tsunami in the Tigris and the Euphrates. But he's not going to. Because you don't deserve that kind of protection. Like the Bnei Israel deserved back then, or it was time back then. It's not time now. You're not getting that. People were actually talking very firm about God's protection and their reliance on Satan. Yirmiyahu says it's not happening. So if you're sure that the end is upon us, right, it's probably a better deal to just surrender. But you know, if you play risk, do you surrender? Do you retreat? You know, right? Should I fight? You fight when you think, you know, I'll get a better deal. Right? You have to know to whom you're surrendering. In some societies, surrender is never the option, like in Japan. But it's good suicide to surrender. Right? At the end of World War II for Germany. Right? But Yirmiyahu predicted surrender. Okay, you with me? It wasn't popular, they didn't. What was the point, though? The point is, because Yirmiyahu had the insider information. If the destruction, if the fall is certain, then surrender is probably a smarter thing to do. Unless the victor is going to wipe everyone out, massacre everybody, right? But if you have inside information from your God, right, that if you surrender, you'll be able to stay, you won't even lose the temple. And I also know that 70 years after this king becomes king, in 609 BCE, that in 539, 538, a new nation is going to rise and wipe these people out and let everyone that was exiled before by the Babylonians in 597 and by the Assyrians in 722, that all those Jews will be invited back, spoiler, by a king named Cyrus. Look at your chart. All right, turn it over and see. Okay? Exactly, 70 years after Nebuchadnezzar rose to the throne, Yirmiyahu's prediction in chapter 25 came true. What's going to be if you surrender? Tell me the difference between what's going to be if you surrender. You'll have hundreds and thousands, millions of Jews in Israel! As opposed to what did happen, which is the Jews put up a valiant fight. Many tens of thousands were killed, probably hundreds of thousands, and the rest were exiled. But Nebuzaradan, chapter 39 of Yirmiyahu, is told that some Jews called for surrender. I don't know if the Iranians would do this, but I do know that the Babylonians did. Yirmiyahu was imprisoned at the time of the Churban. Otherwise, he might have been running out in the streets and saying, no, don't fight them! Don't fight them! Surrender! Surrender! Pick up! Surrendering! He was in jail until the whole Churban was over. Nebuzaradan takes him out of jail and says, we heard that you called for peace. We are allowing you to remain in Israel, to remain with the 400,000, whatever the amount of Jews who are here, pick a leader, and rule over them in safety, in security. We're just controlling this land now. It's strategically important for us in the Mediterranean. We're in control, but you have the autonomy and the independence to run things. He picked a man whose father had saved his life earlier in the book. His name was Gedaliah. Right? So strike one is that the Jews did not surrender so that many hundreds of thousands or even millions would remain in Israel during those 7 years. Right? Strike two is that after many were allowed to remain, right? It says near Yirmiyahu that many Jews took to the caves and and hiding places to fight guerrilla warfare, Yirmiyahu was able to convince them to lay down their arms and come back to Jerusalem. You can live here. Why fight to try to get rid of the Babylonians when you can just come back and live here? You want to fight them to kick them out so you can live here? You can live here! So Gedaliah ruled over a relatively small community of Jews, and you know what happened. His assassination was considered, I mean, because while he was ruling as governor, not as king, but as governor, the Jews had, you could tend your vineyards, you could tend your flocks, it's your land, stay here. Right? This was strike two, because had the Jews remained in Israel, a smaller community, so 200,000 remained in Israel. So when the 70 years are up, right? That's Yirmiyahu Laman Aleph talks about all the promises of what's going to happen, all the good that will happen when the 70 years are up. Right? They were not realized. Because chapter 31 is all the potential for what could happen if you remain in Israel. When Gedaliah was assassinated, the small Jewish community that remained were largely taken into exile. Right? I'm making up some numbers, but 4 million Jews became 400,000 Jews. After Gedaliah was killed, 400,000 Jews became 20,000 Jews, 10,000 Jews. And you know what? Amazingly, the Babylonians still allowed Yirmiyahu to remain in Israel, to lead a nascent Jewish community. I want to make sure everyone in this room gets the point. It's crucial that Jews are living in Israel during the 70-year exile, right? So that when the Persian kings, we don't even know what Persia is yet, but when the next group, 70 years after the Nebuchadnezzar became king, rises to prominence and is kindly disposed towards Jews, when those kings allow Jews to return, right? Think about making Aliyah in 1970. Think about making Aliyah in 1870. Have you ever heard, read reports about what it was like for the very first Jews to make Aliyah?
Swamps.
Even like the malaria. Right? When you don't tend and plow land for 70 years, it becomes mamish like a rock. Mamish. It turns to rock. You don't bring up land, it becomes so hard, it's impossible to grow anything. What Yirmiyahu wanted was for many Jews to remain, so that my predictions can come true of chapter 31, of the potential for all that can be in Baishay. Okay? You see three strikes? Strike one, I told you they didn't surrender. Strike two, they killed Gedaliah. What's strike three? Even if the Gedaliah was killed, the Babylonians allowed Yirmiyahu to remain in Israel. In one of the most absurd chapters in the Bible, I got to tell you, and I run through Tanakh twice a year, this is my most absurd chapter in the Tanakh, even worse than Pilegesh Megiddo. The people go to Yirmiyahu and they say, Yirmiyahu, you know what? Now we see every prediction you made has come true. We see, you were right, you're the true Navi. All those other false prophets, they're dead, they're not here. Everything you said would happen has happened. And now you're telling us that we have the potential to remain and people will come back. What should we do? Tell us, give us instruction. We're without leaders. And Yirmiyahu tells them, be moral, accept God's Torah, da, da, da. But don't go to Egypt. Egypt is the worst place to go right now. I've heard that some Jews are thinking of going down to Egypt. That's a bad idea. The whirlwind that called Bavel that wiped you out here and exiled you here is going down to Bavel. I said, going down to Egypt. Right? They're going to do to Egypt what they just did to you. Why do you want to be in Egypt when that happens? What's the absurdity? They said to him, you're a liar! You're always lying to us! He said, what are you talking about? You said you would listen to me! Right? You crazy? You said you'd listen to me! What? Said, no, we want to be in Egypt. This is a bad place to be. Strike three. Practically every last Jew, they forcibly took Yirmiyahu to Egypt, where he ostensibly died. Which which makes Tosfos and Baba Basra ask, so why does the Gemara say Yirmiyahu wrote Yirmiyahu? He died in Chutz La'aretz. You don't get to write your book in Chutz La'aretz. That's why Yecheskel was written by a chicken as a Gedolei. He was in Bava. Tosfos leaves it unanswered. Maybe what Tosfos should say is, well, maybe Yirmiyahu came back to Israel and that's where he wrote his book. Where he wrote his book before he went to Egypt. I don't know. Be that as it may, that's strike three. Because when Yirmiyahu went to Egypt, that was it. So few Jews came back to remain in Israel so that when its 70 years were over and the Persian kings wonderfully invited the Jews to return, guess what? It's 1870. No one wants to. And you know what the terrible irony is? That if you compare that to 1870, when Jews started to really want to have a place to go, like the 30s, if you know your history, by that time, there was a white paper, there was pogroms, the Arab world was inflamed against any Jew making his way to Israel. Right? 2 million Jews could have in 1890 made their way to Israel. Imagine how different things would be today. Right? I'm not saying it was easy. Okay. But the three strikes, it's like the Meraglim. History is repeating itself. The Meraglim were repeated twice. That's, you know, 4 million Jews or more, for goodness sakes. David had an army of 1.1 million soldiers. This is 500 years later. So there's four, just by interpolation, because Jews were not given to, maybe they were given to assimilation, I doubt it, but they were not, at least by the history, by the Tanakh and whatever other history we know, they were not lost in great numbers by battles, you know, like throughout the Middle Ages, you know, pogroms and things, and persecutions, and inquisitions, and expulsions, right? So our numbers must have been 5-6 million, right? The 5 million Jews living in the time of Yirmiyahu, and they go into exile, right? And how many return with Ezra and Nehemiah? 42,360. You say, wow, those are good numbers. It's awful. It's awful. That's what Ba'ishei did not produce what Yirmiyahu in chapter 31 said it would. And Chagai, a small book of two chapters that predicts, if you build me this temple and you put your heart into it, this temple will be greater than the first one. Right? Remember the two explanations I gave from the Gemara about that? How was this temple greater than the first one? The amount of years it stood?
It lasted longer, and Herod.
Or Herod made it more beautiful. So with Chagai, according to Chagai, the only way it was a nicer Beis HaMikdash had to wait 400 years till we learned that it stood longer. It says in Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah that when they brought the people to rebuild the temple, the people 80 or 90 years old all cry because they said, this is nothing compared to what we remember from our youth of the first temple. Why? Because the people remained in Chutz La'aretz. Why? Because things were so bad for the Jews in Israel. There was nothing there for them. So what happened? They assimilated. That gets you into Malachi. Zechariah and Malachi both refer, Malachi explicitly, Zechariah only through visions. Zechariah has 13 visions in his book. They are very cryptic, very difficult to understand. There are some cases where Zechariah himself doesn't appear to understand what the nature of his vision is about. One of them is very famous, you know it. It's the Haftorah of Shabbos Chanukah, of a menorah with numerous hundreds of tubes leading into both sides of the menorah from two olive trees. He has a vision of assimilation where the high priest is wearing putrid clothes that he has to take off because his sons are intermarried. And he speaks about the few who defeat the many in the Spirit of God. Zechariah says, I don't know what this is about. What are these trees? What is that menorah? What is the Kohen Gadol doing here? And Hashem says, basically, it hasn't happened yet. That's why you don't understand. Those are the three elements of the Chavamish story. Assimilation, Hellenism, right? The few defeating the many, and an everlasting, never-ending supply of oil that you'll find somehow. Which is why the Noah is the main focus of the Chavamish story. We should eat bread on Chanukah because the Shulchan was returned, right? Why are we celebrating the Menorah? It was just one part of the return of the rededication of the temple. Because of Zechariah's prophecy. That prophecy takes place in the middle of his 13 visions. The first one and the last one both involve three horses following a fourth into some kind of travel. Okay. Abarbanel, remember this name, Abarbanel, explains that all 13 of these visions are actually crucial historical events between my time and the Messianic era. That's what Abarbanel says. I'll tell you in 2 minutes why he's obviously wrong. He says that the first vision of three horses following a fourth is Alexander the Great leading his kingdoms into three divisions. Europe, Middle East, and Africa. Right? The last one, which is in his own day, right? Abarbanel was living at the time of the Spanish expulsion. The last one, he says, is Columbus sailing to the New World with three ships. And he says that that's going to inaugurate the Messianic era. I say he's wrong because it didn't, but he may be right in that he believed that that opening to a new world was going to change the fortunes of the Jews. And he's right about that. Pilgrims, the English, the United States of America, he's right about that. But it's not the end of the book, it's just chapter 6. The rest of the book might tell us. I mean, this prophecy is later in the book that are amazing. It says about God stomping his foot right between Jerusalem, breaking it off into two. And Jews on one side will have a good, Jews on the other side will have a bad, until shortly afterwards, the two sides of Jerusalem will be united, much to the joy of all the people. That's 49 and 67, right? It tells all kinds of, if you want to know about prophecies in Tanakh and how they're directed to our day now, look at the end of Zechariah. But be careful, it's very good. For every time we do something like that, the Christians can also do probably something. And they do. Right? But the point is that both Haggai and Zechariah, Malachi talks about the assimilation during this time, both Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi refer to this great promise of what could be. Problem is, two things. What's a greater threat to Jewish continuity? One thing could be persecution. They persecute us. They don't let us sit in our shuls. They don't let us build a base medrash. They don't let us have equal status. They don't let us have equal opportunity. You know what? Jews did okay with that. What does worse for Jewish continuity is when they love us too much. And that's Malachi. Malachi complains about rampant assimilation and the Jewish men. It's always the men with the non-Jewish women. Right? You go to a conversion class, people who want to convert because they're dating a Jew, it's 80% men, Jewish men, and you know, the Jewish men marrying non-Jewish women. That was the case in the time of Malachi. And the Jewish women have no one to marry. Malachi complains about that. He took on, and Ezra Nehemiah actually lists, at the end of Ezra Nehemiah lists the intermarried men. Huh. Imagine doing that today. The heads of many a federation are intermarried. So, in that list, in both lists of Ezra and Nehemiah, are the Kohen Gadol's own two sons. Which is why in the Chanukah vision, the Kohen Gadol is told, take off your putrid clothes, that's your sons who are intermarried. But a Shanda, even the Kohen Gadol's own sons are intermarried. Right? That's how rampant it was. Do you see what's happening now? You're getting a picture of the, and Daniel is here, the last one that I haven't discussed yet, because Daniel says, God, I don't know when these 70 years are supposed to be over. What's going on? It's been 80 years. It's been 85 years. God says, oh, Daniel, Yirmiyahu mentioned two different cheshbonot of 70 years. Okay? You see what's happening? It was supposed to be for 70 years a big draw for Jews to come back to Israel. Because there's been 400,000 Jews living there all this time. The vineyards are kept. Gedaliah's grandson is serving as the chief governor of all of Israel now. Right? There's land for everybody. Just come back in and get your 40 acres. You hear it? Who wouldn't come back with those terms? Why would I want to live here under the yoke of Assyria when I can go back to Israel? Yechezkel is not on this list, actually. Speaks, it's not Torah, Parshas Parah. He speaks about the obvious point that every Jew would want to live to Israel, move to Israel, if he has the opportunity to do so. So, the problem is that people didn't want to, because it was really awful in Israel. They didn't listen to Yirmiyahu. They struck out. They said three strikes. A, they didn't originally surrender. Those figs, remember? B, they killed Gedaliah. And C, they took Yirmiyahu to the last community they took to Egypt. Now, how does Esther fit in? Esther shows why it was doubly difficult to return to Israel. It relates to Malachi. Tell me.
No Jews were keeping the land fertile.
That's one reason not to go. What's a reason to stay?
In Babylon?
Oh, well, Persia, wherever they were.
Queen of Persia.
Because it's so good for us.
Yeah, freedom of culture.
Right? They were assimilating. They're marrying us. They're letting us marry Babylonian women. Huh? We love it here. Get it? Now cue into the beginning of our story. Only two cities in Tanakh are called Bira. They are Yerushalayim HaBira and Shushan HaBira. The first perek of Megillat Esther, if you read it the right way, is all about, and it's of course it's the way Chazal read it, it's all about how Shushan is replacing Yerushalayim in the eyes of the Jews. We don't need the chotzer of the Beis HaMikdash with all its glory for Bais Rishon. We have the chotzer of Ahasuerus's court, and we're invited to drink together with all the other Persians. Right? You can get used to this. We're equals here. Right? It's sort of like the American experience. After 800, 900 years of such a crusade, or longer, who knows what, you know, we don't know much about what life was like for Jews. It's in the year 600, near 800 in Europe. But it was no picnic, right? The Muslims started to pile on then also, okay? So, but what's happening here is that they're killing us with kindness. It's an amazing medrash that says, if you see the numbers where I write 6 times 5 times 180, you see that? I put some numbers there at the top. Did you get it? Right? It's the whole Megillah in front of you. We'll just put that. Just put that. Right, you see those numbers, 6 times 5 times 180? There's Gemara in the Sefer Megillah that says, tries to explain why, when we read about the drinking that they were doing, why do we read that with Eichon Trump? Right? Look at Pasuk Zayin. V'hashkaos b'chnei zahav v'chelim b'kelim shonim v'yei malchus rav kiyan ha-melech. Anybody here late? Megill? But you know you laid that with Eichon, right? Why? What's so Eichadik about the fact that they were drinking from Kelim? Rashi quotes the Gemara Megillah that says that they were glorifying in the drinking of the Kelim of the Beis HaMikdash. Ahasuerus was, and here's the point, I underlined some of the words describing the splendor and the grandeur. These are words and colors. Butz, Argaman, Sheish. It's not this week, but next week's Parsha. These are words that are only used in Tanakh. Colors that are only found in Tanakh, or mostly found in Tanakh, regarding the Mishkan and Shlomo's Beis HaMikdash. Megillas Esther is a parody. It's a satire. It's describing Ahasuerus's grandeur in the terms that the careful biblical reader knows is used with regards to the Beis HaMikdash. You ever hear of the Medrash that the clothing that Ahasuerus wore to this party on the first day was none other than
Bidei
Kehuna. He wore the Kohen Gadol's garments. Had nothing. The gems, he had the Choshen. He had it all. He was wearing it. When a Medrash says something like this, I'm not interested in the historical truth of it. I'm interested in the deeper meaning of it. Ahasuerus wants to replace in the eyes of his people everything you knew about your Beis HaMikdash, everything you knew about your holy city is now Persian. It's like what the French did in the 1790s. They said to the Jews as a nation, no rights whatsoever. To Jews as individuals, all rights as a Frenchman. That's what Ahasuerus wants. I will make you equal partners in my drinking party. You just have to forget about Yerushalayim. In Ezra chapter 1, it says that the Persian kings allowed all the Kalim to return, and they numbered 5,400. The Gemara Megillah says, and I'm making this connection, it says the party lasted 180 days. They showed 5 different types of officials, 6 different types of grandeur and splendor from the Beis HaMikdash. Those numbers mean that they showed 5,400 Kalim, the Kalim Shonim, and that's why we laid it with Eichatrup. Do you get my point? Do you see a hidden message here? We can't put this out exactly. We have to be careful. It's the Persians who are sending this message out. You hear it? Okay? Does everybody here feel satisfied that we are getting a hidden message of what this Megillah is really about? It's not about the Jews of Persia. It's about the Jews of Israel. Who's going? Who's not going? This is a Stama story. There are lots of them. There are 100 of them. Look at Pia in the Encyclopedia Judaica again. Right? There's much more to this story than if we read it this way and see who Haman was. I submit to you that Haman appears in Sefer Ezra Nehemiah. A different name and a different focus. But he's there. What does he care? What does he say? Ishnam Echad wrote. He cares about the Jews as a fifth column. Don't care about Persia, they don't care about Israel. Okay, we're going to see what all this is about. Okay, we're going to learn it inside in the text. Make sure you come with this text, but especially this list of Persian kings next time. And we will continue from there. Great Shabbos, everybody.
Good.